Chapter 10. So much was still possible, Maynard believed, and nothing would get in his way. Few performances were on the docket, and no romantic entanglements, and with the departure of Pepper Spray Jerry and the arrival of a new housemate, Tool guitar tech Billy Howardell, the LaMeda house had settled into a comfortable domestic routine. He would take advantage of the calm and focus on the next album. But the universe, he should have known by then, has a habit of bollocksing the best of intentions. One telephone call, and his every certainty was replaced with doubt. Fatherhood was one piece of the puzzle that hadn't exactly been on his radar. "My dad hadn't been around for me when I was young," he would recall. "Now here I was in a similar situation, which sucked. I didn't want to repeat that pattern. I wanted to break it." Of his many doomed romances, this had been the one ended not in door slamming or restraining orders, but level-headed kindness. After only a few dates, the two had recognized their passion wasn't destined for the long term and had said their respectful goodbyes. "We agreed as adults that it wasn't working, and we parted ways," Maynard recalled. "I finally handled a breakup the way it should be handled." A white picket fence and a two-car garage weren't entirely out of the question. The year before, he'd congratulated Kurt on his marriage and the birth of his daughter, not without a little envy. He imagined that one day it would be his turn to gather with family at the dinner table every night and spend Saturdays teaching his children to plant peas and lettuce in the garden behind the house. But not yet. Not now. "I wanted all that. But I wanted to be with the right person," he would explain. But whatever his fears, whatever his reservations and regrets, this child, his child, would never doubt his love, never twist in its car seat to catch one last glimpse of its father. If he and the baby's mother had managed a respectful breakup, he resolved, surely they could maintain that civility for the sake of their baby. Maynard's demands were few but firm. He'd have a say in choosing the best schools and the best orthodontists. His child would spend Christmas with him, and together they'd sprinkle cookies with powdered sugar and create pinecone Santas and hang them on their real tree. "It's just a ride," Bill Hicks had told him often enough. "No matter what," he'd said, "things would always work out." Maybe so. But just now, Maynard was hard-pressed to reconcile instant family with his artistic ambitions, not to mention an increasing abhorrence for the city he lived in. "There are those moments when you feel like you're losing touch with your identity," he would later explain. The Melchizedek tapes had only scratched the surface in helping him to understand cosmic order, and when he saw the announcement of an upcoming Flower of Life seminar, he drafted his tuition check and cleared his daytimer. A week-long immersion in Melchizedek's teachings of pattern and structure might bring the clarity he needed. Early each day, Maynard arrived at the house in San Fernando Valley and joined his fellow students in a meditation, visualizing the creative energies supposedly crackling in the instructor's living room. She lectured on tragedy and hope and the mathematical formulas that formed Melchizedek's teachings, while Maynard and the others sat on their pillows and exchanged smiles as if they shared in some great secret. After lunch, the lights were dimmed, and Melchizedek's image filled the screen against one wall. Maynard watched, rapt, as the ponytailed guru enlightened the group about the Earth's forgotten histories, of extraterrestrials who'd long ago come from the star Sirius and left their mysterious marks upon the land, of Stonehenge and the pyramids on the Giza Plateau, their designs suggesting some occult universal system of measurement. In the evening, over IPAs in the backyard, Maynard updated Gary and Billy on the day's lessons. He reported on the cataclysmic changes to come, changes predicted for millennia by seers long separated by space and time. "Any time now," Melchizedek had taught, "great seismic shifts would heave the Earth's plates and set them down again, willy-nilly, creating a new landscape of ocean waves crashing over Arizona. As best he could, he told them of the new breed of humans beginning to populate the Earth, a race evolved with not only the usual 46 chromosomes, but an additional 2, equipping them to usher in an age of cosmic consciousness, a race Melchizedek called Indigo Children.
"My friends thought I was fucking bananas," Maynard would recall.
"I don't care whether there's aliens or not. That's a great story and it makes for great movies. The more logical story, just like Crowley wrote on Egypt, is that there are way more histories to the world than one could imagine, and that the records of them survive violent changes throughout time. But it's not aliens. It's just us leaving messages for each other. And I don't believe in psychic power stuff. I do believe in creative energies. I believe information is out there if you just tune to it. I don't think it's anything spiritual, it's just there. If all of a sudden people on different continents discovered electricity, it's not like they had some cosmic internet and shared that information. It's just that on some unconscious level, people end up being at the same stage of readiness."
The seminar included somewhat more pragmatic topics as well. The principles of sacred geometry, Melchizedek claimed, manifest themselves in all things seen and unseen. The universe hums with the energy of the Fibonacci sequence, a series of numbers, each the sum of the two that precede it, the mathematical pattern that determines the shape of the spiraling galaxies, and hurricanes, too, and garden snails, and cochlea inside the human ear. The larger-than-life Melchizedek spoke from the screen, and Maynard scribbled notes, imagining sketches or even lyrics he might create based on this new knowledge. Every emotion, Melchizedek claimed, love and compassion, fear and anguish, has its unique sine wave signature, and neuro-researchers had recorded and then converted them to three-dimensional polyhedrons, their angles and lines as predictable as the recursive patterns of a Bach fugue, as precise as a Midwestern highway grid. "Those patterns have to do with consciousness," Maynard would explain. "They clearly have to do with art and music and how your body reacts to their structures. When artists figured out this mathematical proportion thing, they created paintings that vibrate in us at more powerful frequencies. The same with classical music. Beethoven could barely hear. He wrote music based on math, and that music makes you cry." "Even synchronicity and coincidence," Melchizedek explained, "are natural and expected expressions of mathematical order. Nothing magical about them. Real magic happens with consciousness, the force that causes events and intentions to come into being in the first place." Maynard sat forward as Melchizedek trained his laser pointer on images of circles, of angles and arcs and simple geometric forms. "Any beginner," Melchizedek explained, "can take up compass and straight edge and pen and draw triangles and squares, pentagrams and hexagons, and the star in all its variations, the cross and the Star of David and the swastika. But to reach the next level, to draw a form no compass, no spirograph, no idle doodler can produce, is to enter into the divine. Participation and will are required to draw the heptagram, the star of 7 lines, 7 interlocking nodes, 7 points. 7, the number of chakras as the Buddhists count them, the number neo-pagans give to the entrance to the realm of fairy. 7, the holiest of holy numbers, signifying the completion of God's creative act. When a man applies conscious thought and draws a 7-pointed star, he becomes with God a co-creator of the universe."
If I built on Melchizedek's principles, not that I understood any of them, at least I could get something out of the classes. I wanted to do more. I wanted to create. I wanted a quality of life, and I wanted to take care of my child. I wanted to boil Melchizedek's story down to the basics and understand the practical nature of geometry as it applies to emotions, to human behavior, to music, to architecture, to food, to wine.
When the final class was dismissed, Maynard pulled his battered 4-track recorder from the back of his closet and experimented with vocal levels from whisper to scream. he replayed Bill Hicks's cassettes and considered the union of comedy and tragedy, the vibrations that might exist between them, the intersections that might produce in an audience deep resonance. Maynard has a very practical, logical side, Moon Zappa explained. You can hear it in the complex point of entry where he brings a story to you. He can direct information. And you can only do that if you're working on yourself, discovering and doing deep work. And the orange moon followed its own geometric trajectory across the LA sky as Maynard curled on his bed with pen and ink and tried his hand at sketching 7 pointed stars. If, as Melchizedek believed, as Bill Hicks had predicted, and the Bible, too, the end times were just around the corner, it would probably be a good idea to be prepared. Okay, I signed on for this ride, and if I couldn't jump off, I at least needed to be able to physically endure it, Maynard explained. I had to be ready to defend myself or defend my space. At least I had to become centered enough to stay calm in the face of whatever might happen. Tool's local performances that winter had featured the innovative metal band Laundry, and over the months, its drummer, Tim Alexander, had become a frequent guest at the house on Lameda. He arrived one afternoon, updated Maynard on his work with Primus, paid the obligatory visit to Butterball, and presented to Maynard a set of VHS tapes of the pay-per-view Ultimate Fighting Championship. This was geometric principle in action, Maynard realized. Long after he should have returned to his writing, he marveled at Hoyce Gracie, UFC founder and its 3-time champion, as he bested opponent after opponent with his singular jiu-jitsu moves. The Gracies, Tim explained, Hoyce, his father Elio, and his brother Hickson, had made it their mission to revolutionize mixed martial arts, to incorporate into jiu-jitsu cross-training and new ways of applying leverage and sensitivity to turn an adversary's energy against himself.
In those days, every martial arts studio claimed theirs was the best, and they could teach you how to kill a man in under 5 seconds. I love to be a part of a movement that's calling bullshit, and the Gracies were clearing up mysteries and nonsense surrounding most of the other martial arts and all their dance steps. And these guys were actually fairly nonviolent. Half the time, they disabled their opponent without even striking.
Maynard was soon a regular at Hickson's LA studio, studying grappling and joint locks and chokes under the black belts there. He learned to transmute his body to fulcrum and pivot to maintain a disciplined control of his torso and limbs, of line and leverage and angle. That was the beauty of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, he would recall. I was learning physical, practical skills that kept me grounded during a time when I was trying to figure out what really mattered and trying to maintain my center in this ocean of chaos in L.A. Bill Hicks's death, at 32 and with so much yet to accomplish, left Maynard with a sense of urgency. He'd seen bands achieve sudden fame, receive accolades and awards and astonishing royalties. He'd seen the downside of success, too, the one-dimensional existence that came of the single-minded focus required to stay in the spotlight. Tool was moving in a direction that was keeping me from pursuing other interests and dreams, Maynard explained. I felt I had to do something before we got to the point of no return. The Diamond Club on Hollywood Boulevard offered an eclectic lineup from disco on Saturdays to Wednesday night comedy. Laura Milligan's tantrum shows weren't the predictable stand-up monologues and time-worn mother-in-law jokes, but variety shows of mini-skits and offbeat humor, and Maynard and his friends made it their go-to spot to experience the new generation of comics, Kathy Griffin and Bobcat Goldthwait, Janine Garofalo and Margaret Cho and Mark Feit, and David Cross and Bob Odenkirk, whose sketch comedy series Mr. Show would premiere in November on HBO. He looked forward most to the recurring comedy club within a comedy club routine featuring Laura's character, Tawny Port, a former child star who descended into the shadow world of drugs and rock star romances and had only now begun her climb from the cycle of self-abuse. Recently released from yet another rehab program, Tawny had turned to comedy as her first step in re-entering the limelight. The skits always ended with the same gimmick. Tawny stood alone on the stage, waiting for her down-on-his-luck boyfriend Vince to appear with his band and close the show. He'd never show up, Laura explained. The show always had this anticlimactic ending. The disappointing denouement was humorous enough, but Maynard imagined taking the sketch further. What if, he suggested, Vince did show up, and not alone, but with his ragtag band in tow? The attentive man with the shaved head, Laura had learned, might know a thing or two about music, and, intrigued by his idea, she agreed to offer him a few lines in the next week's performance. "So I became the boyfriend," Maynard would recall. The disco bass that pounded into tantrum from the main room only added to the realism of the routines. It was perfect, Laura would recall. The premise was that Vince's band was making this pathetic attempt to get industry people to come see their act on a weeknight, so the more that could go wrong, the better. As Tawny wrapped her routine, Maynard and Adam and Sean took the stage in wigs and spandex pants, red suspenders and t-shirts, fedoras and cat-in-the-hat hats. Every time Vince's band showed up, it would be a little different, because they couldn't keep it together to last longer than a week or two, Maynard explained. They took up their guitars in a parody of the wannabe bands he'd scorned when he'd arrived in L.A. Their music didn't much improve from week to week, even as the band's name changed from Twisted Mister to D'Artagnan Canyon to Umlaut to Recreational Racist.
"My firm belief is that comedy, to quote Steve Martin, isn't pretty. Comedy is bound to offend somebody. It's self-deprecating, or somebody else is getting thrown under the bus. We have to laugh at ourselves. Never mind that some guy writes a cool song and puts a nice video online. That's not what gets the traffic. Fatty falls down a hole in a convenience store. That's the one that goes viral. Somebody's the butt of that joke. Deal with it. I'm the butt of many jokes, but I'm not going to lose any sleep over it."
The audience sang along, clapped and shouted for more when Laura, in cowgirl hat and boots, joined Maynard's Billy Dee character in leisure suit and wig and mustache in a body performance of the old Tom Morello and Adam Jones song, Country Boner. Performing as part of a collective freed Maynard to test new personas and material a frontman dare not explore. "There was less judgment in doing comedy than in music," he would explain. "I could go into that space with other comedians and be a side note. I wanted to pursue this and figure out how I could do more. This was fun." By early summer, his role had expanded from member of the comedy chorus to creative collaborator. "We'd spend all week putting themes together," Laura remembered. "We'd come up with ideas, and Maynard ran with them and helped produce a lot of those shows. He always got so excited talking about this stuff. His eyes would light up, and it's almost like he was rubbing his palms together." The players might don white lab coats and head mirrors and portray doctors come waiters. The Diamond Club, according to the script, had been purchased by a restaurant chain, its theme a surgical practice complete with cocktails wheeled to the tables on gurneys. Until Tantrum's lease expired, the show would go on while Dr. O'Cudahy's served its patrons. Maynard made table tents, Laura explained. Instead of regular menu items, he listed things like colostomy baguettes and tater cysts, just horrid medically themed appetizers. "While some poor bastard like Craig Anton was up on the stage trying to do his bit," Maynard remembered, "the rest of us, David Cross, me, and a couple of other people, stood at the back of the room and whirred about 32 mixed-drink blenders." Their working-class, fundamentalist backgrounds created between Cross and Maynard an instant camaraderie, the foundation for long hours of conversation on any topic at all, discussions at times heated, but always ending in unexpected insights and laughter. "Maynard's really an intense dude. That's probably the number one reason we connected," Cross recalled in a 2013 interview.
I knew early on that he deeply appreciates comedy, and more specifically, pointed comedy about cultural hypocrisy and politics and religion. The first time I hung out with him, he invited me to his house in the valley. He was conscious of the fact that we were doing man stuff, Cross recalled of Maynard's carefully choreographed evening of animal care, jiu-jitsu, and red meat. He definitely appreciated the irony of saying, I just gotta feed my lizard and then we'll watch UFC and cook up these steaks. And after their meal, and after cheering on the Gracies, they sat over pale ale discussing the roles they'd take in next week's tantrum show, the progress on Cross's upcoming TV program, and Tool's next album, like-minded compañeros offering encouragement and support. Many comedians are mean-spirited and jealous and petty and want to see others fail. Maynard isn't like that, Laura explained. He wants to uplift, and he has really high standards. I think he feels let down when people don't measure up to their potential. If Tool's fans recognized him on the tantrum stage, Maynard realized, they'd no doubt fear his new ventures would dilute his commitment to the band. But he knew, too, that an infusion of comedy could only enhance his music.
I still wanted to see if I could blend comedy and music in a way that made sense. I felt like I could offer another dimension. I'm not a drummer, so I wasn't going to move in that direction. I'm not a guitar player. I'm a storyteller. As I expanded my palette, everything would benefit from everything else.
This new venture wasn't exactly a parody band. It wasn't a country band either, or a shift to comedy or theatrical production. It was, if it must be named, a project of many facets, each dependent on all the others. A project that would spiral in unexpected directions as its course became clear. A project he'd call Pussifer. Maynard stood on one foot. Keeping his balance wasn't hard, and he tipped his head back and stretched his fingers toward the sky. A warm wind swirled around his outspread arms, then gently lifted him until he soared above the village. It didn't seem in the least odd that he could fly. He floated there, suspended in the sunshine, and looked down at weathered wooden buildings set along dusty streets, at roads winding in switchbacks and hairpin curves through green valleys and copper-gold mountains. The dream came more often now, always more detailed, and each time he awoke satisfied and content. He didn't question the source of the dream or what his subconscious was telling him. I didn't feel like anything in L.A. resonated properly, he recalled. It didn't feel good there. Tool's royalties didn't yet provide the income required to enjoy the city in style, and he'd had his fill of gridlock and smog, ruthless competition, and relationships he couldn't quite trust. And the music landscape had lost not a little of its appeal with the demise of Raji's and Ghazari's and Club Lingerie. Maynard needed only a place to lay his head when Tool was in rehearsal or recording, and he cringed when he considered his certain future should he remain in L.A. I knew if I stuck around I was going to get sucked into the red carpet at the Grammys scene, he would remember. I had to get out and regain some connection with the land and with space where there wasn't a lot of noise and distraction. He'd moved enough times to know that no matter where he lived, he needn't lose his friends. David Cross, Moon Zappa, or Tim Alexander, despite their inauspicious meeting during the Lollapalooza tour. I remember him walking toward me backstage where all the buses were parked, Tim recalled. He had a mohawk at the time, and it reminded me of Robert De Niro's character in Taxi Driver. I didn't know who he was, so when I saw him headed in my direction, I became a bit concerned, not knowing what this strange person could possibly want. The two had since become allies, and Maynard related to Tim his recurring dream and his suspicion that the place in his vision might be Arizona. He didn't particularly want to live there, he explained. When Tool had performed in Phoenix, Maynard had found it just one more congested urban maze crowded with secretaries and CEOs parading in lockstep to their cubicles. But Tim told him of another Arizona. An Arizona of rugged mountains and wide skies, of sudden cloudbursts that eased the summer heat and cleared to bright, balmy afternoons,
of a town that sounded to him very much like the village in Maynard's dream. Tim said he needed to take me on a little trip, Maynard would remember. The Buckskins and the Harquahalas and the Eagletails extended mile after mile across western Arizona, unbroken by forest or highway, their peaks and gorges resolving in sharp relief as the plane began its slow descent over the Phoenix airport. Midsummer wasn't the ideal time for a road trip through the desert. July was the state's hottest month, with temperatures expected that day to top 110 degrees. But Maynard was eager to visit the town his friend had described and ignored the thermometer. Tim lowered the top of the rental car, and Maynard ran his finger along the interstate marked in a thick green line in his Rand McNally. In 2 hours, he determined, they'd reach their destination, so long as they kept close watch on the fuel gauge and calculated the distance between the tiny towns along the way, where trading posts might or might not sell gasoline. Their northbound route took them through flatlands brown with scrub, the Johnson grass and mullein at the road's shoulder drooping in the heat. They passed Rock Springs and Turret Peak and Towers Mountain, and looming outcroppings barren of vegetation. At the horizon, the Weavers and the Sierra Anchas rose in purple-gray haze, and the cloudless sky reflected in the heat mirage that shimmered always before them across the asphalt. They drove higher, above the tree line, above the frost line, where even cactus did not grow. Through the foothills they climbed, their ears popping, until they turned at last from the interstate at Camp Verde. "We came over the crest into the Verde Valley," Maynard remembered, "and my heart started to race. What I saw was so familiar." They'd reached a promontory nearly a mile above sea level, a place of green meadows and stands of Arizona elder, willow, and walnut and sycamore. The gentle climb along the ridge paralleled the valley, the gorge bounded by towering mountains, a vista he'd never known, but recognized all the same. Not far ahead were Cornville and Cottonwood, and the old highway that wound in switchbacks past billboards announcing Dead Horse Ranch State Park, and a bit farther, Cleopatra Hill, the mountain formed nearly 2 million years before by a volcanic eruption beneath the vast Precambrian inland sea. Maynard and Tim looked out on the United Verde open pit, the 300-foot-deep reminder of the area's copper mining heyday at the turn of the 20th century. And just up the road was Jerome, the tiny town of brick and wooden buildings perched on the mountain's face. Jerome was a collection of antique shops and cafes, art galleries and boxy brick hotels, weathered storefronts like the television versions of Virginia City and Dodge Maynard remembered from evenings in the Ohio living room. None of the buildings were particularly square. They stood pitched at odd angles along the canted streets, victims of gravity and decades of settling mine shafts beneath the town. The sidewalks might be crowded come the weekend, but just now, only a few pedestrians walked about, friendly enough strangers who nodded in greeting as Maynard and Tim made their way up Clark Street and down Main, streets arranged in parallel terraces up the mountainside and crisscrossed by steep flights of concrete steps. Maynard read the brightly painted signage advertising gemstones and pottery and pizza and looked out at the far ridges of the Mogollon Rim. And he knew again the sensation he'd known in his dream, the feeling that he had come home. "We stopped at the Flatiron Cafe," he would recall. Brian and Alan, the managers, introduced themselves right away, and their amazing Italian espresso was the last piece of the puzzle. I said, "I'm living here."
My gut and my heart and my head were practically screaming in three-part harmony that this was where I was supposed to be. If you've ever met your soulmate, you've felt that. You just know. No one has to talk you into it. Your intuition and your instinct tell you this is the one. When I got to Jerome, I thought I was going to pass out because this was the little town from my dream.
Fewer than 400 people lived in Jerome, and the town proper was less than a mile square. But as he walked its dusty streets, Maynard imagined the dreams of long-ago miners who'd built this town, and the Yavapai and Apache before them, and people from the cities more recently come to stay. and he knew that should he live the rest of his life in this small place, it would not be long enough to learn all its stories and secrets, its promises and possibilities. In this mile-high town, borders dissolved in a vista of valley and mountain and sky. Maynard might turn down Hill Street, climb higher to Hull Avenue, but wherever he stepped, he would be part of the vista he walked through, and as limitless. Here he might discover the profound silences and sounds of the desert, turn to song its legends of hill and light, read the weather and the sky and the soil, and tend the things that would grow here. The doctors had said his child would be born in the first week of August, but that was no reason to bow out of his commitments to Tool. The August 6th Big Melee Festival in Oahu would put the band on the bill with Rancid, Down by Law, Face to Face, and Guttermouth, and Maynard looked forward to the final performance before starting work on the next album. Surely he'd be back on the mainland well before the baby made its appearance. But when the plane set down at Honolulu International, he checked his pager and discovered that sometimes babies paid attention to due dates after all. "I had to do the right thing and be there for the birth," Maynard recalled. "I sent the band on ahead and told them I'd try to be back the next night in time for the show." He darted through the terminal, imagining the baby's mother, 2,500 miles away, repeating the deep breathing exercises she'd learned in Lamaze class. He'd never quite understood their purpose, but he practiced them now as he negotiated with the ticket agent and fidgeted during the flight delay and suffered the stop-and-start cab ride through the more frustrating than ever L.A. gridlock. He arrived at the hospital, harried and exhausted, where the baby's mother lay upon her pillows, a cassette player at her bedside, the baby an hour old. The nurse nestled the child in Maynard's arms, and he moved the edge of the blanket back from his face, stroked his fingers, held his tiny head against his own. "I couldn't say anything," he remembered. "I just played Kashmir over and over." Kashmir, the song that seemed a portal to connection and synchronicity, the song to welcome Maynard's son, the child with wide brown eyes and thick dark curls, the baby they named Devo. Ticket holders were plenty disappointed when they found Tool missing from the Big Melee lineup. Another flight delay had kept Maynard from the island after all. But the no-show was forgiven the next year with the release of Tool's new record, the 15-song collection that would debut at number 2 on the Billboard 200 chart and prove to be anything but the uninspired and stereotypic third album. Before the critical acclaim, before the international tour and the Grammy Award and triple platinum status, the band must resolve the creative standstill interrupting the album's progress. "We'd worked individually on a few lyrics and some music," Maynard recalled. "We met for long sound checks and practices and rehearsals, but we didn't seem to be getting anywhere." The teamwork that had come so effortlessly in the past seemed elusive, as if with maturity and new interests, the four had begun to lose sight of their common goals. By midsummer, it was clear that, like Maynard's, Paul's objectives had broadened. His taste in music had shifted from the heavy riffs a Tool song would demand, and he felt ready to realize the dream he'd abandoned in Washington and form his own group. Paul's departure created another challenge, identifying the bass player whose learning curve would not further delay the band's work. "We were looking for someone with a wellspring of ideas and talent," Maynard would recall. "Two things were most important. They had to be a very competent player, and they had to be somebody we liked." Candidates were dismissed one after the other, flawless players who couldn't quite grasp the band's philosophies, personable musicians who arrived for their auditions unprepared, professionals with perfect execution and prior commitments. When Danny and Adam suggested they consider the Peach bass player they'd met the year before, Maynard agreed. Justin Chancellor's low end had brought to Tool a welcome complexity, and a transatlantic phone call later, he'd committed to join them. "I pulled a dog-eared slip of paper out of my pocket," Maynard would recall.
I unfolded it and showed it to Adam and Danny. The piece of paper that said, Paul and London. It kind of blew their minds. With Chancellor on board and the band's momentum restored, Maynard could forget his concerns and devote time to his new pursuits, at least until album production began in earnest. Since Tool's earliest shows, Maynard had spoken with countless reporters who'd powered their way through their questions and allowed him only truncated responses before moving on to the next. It was weird being interviewed, he would later admit. Most of these people had already anticipated my answers, so they didn't even bother listening to what I said. It was time to turn the tables and ask a few questions himself, to create the sort of interview he'd like to read. Bikini Magazine was willing to accept a submission, and Hicks and Gracie agreed to an interview as Maynard's first subject. If he wanted a deeper understanding of Gracie and his beliefs, perhaps readers would too, and he guided his instructor through a candid exploration of jiu-jitsu philosophy, the mathematical principles his father had applied to the discipline, and the balance of body, mind, and spirit that guaranteed joy on the hiking trail and victory in the ring. The piece would need a bit of editing before it would be published the next September. But in the meantime, Maynard received a second assignment. Editors at the San Diego publication Hypno, the World Journal of Popular Culture, were impressed enough with the Gracie draft that they suggested he try his hand at a similar piece for their magazine. His choice of an interviewee, he realized, was a long shot, but he was prepared. Maynard had imagined the things he would ask her for a long time, their conversation should he ever have the chance to speak with her. I told them if I was going to interview anybody, he would explain, I'd like to talk with Joni Mitchell. His open-ended questions allowed Mitchell to speak at length of her unconventional chord progressions, her melodic structures and alternative tunings. Their dialogue branched in unexpected turnings and illuminating tangents from the synesthesia of color and sound to the mathematical basis of a Mozart composition, to the way minor chords resonate with the rhythm of the soul. I think she was comfortable speaking to me because I was an artist, he explained. I didn't come in with an agenda. She was able to just talk stream of consciousness about music and process rather than having to jam sound bites into a predetermined format. Published in Hypno's October 1995 issue, the three-page spread was illustrated with photos of Maynard and Mitchell, their hands clasped, their smiles wide as if caught by the photographer mid-conversation before a cozy fireplace as they shared stories and a fine Shiraz. And in November, HBO aired the inaugural episode of Mr. Show, the series created by Maynard's tantrum colleagues, David Cross and Bob Odenkirk. Among the sketches was a 9-minute routine featuring Cross as Ronnie Dobbs, a trailer trash troublemaker catapulted to fame by Odenkirk's television program documenting his arrests, and Maynard, in a badly cropped wig and the blue and gold cross-country t-shirt he'd worn in high school, made his own TV debut. Partway through the skit, he and Adam performed as the Dobbs tribute band, a band called Pussifer. Whatever Maynard did, there was always a light bulb that would go off that he could meld comedy and music, Laura would recall. HBO viewers knew what to expect of a variety show format and didn't question a rock band's sudden appearance in the middle of a comedy sketch. But audiences weren't so forgiving when it came to humor as part of a live concert. In December, we brought Tenacious D to open for us in San Diego, Maynard explained. They got fucking quarters thrown at them. They'd been audience favorites at Tantrum, but their clowning was lost on the Soma crowd, who pelted the stage in a rain of coins and silenced their routine with shouts of, "We want Tool." The band's name was as much in demand as its music. Social justice organizations and environmentalist groups seemed to believe that if their fundraising events included a Tool performance, contributions would roll in and the rainforests would be saved, political prisoners freed, and puppies in South America rescued from starvation.
It was heartbreaking to be in a position where people were coming to us saying, "We value your name enough to attach it to this event, which will help somebody," I'm sure many of these organizations were legitimate, but you often find that a huge percentage comes off the top for people who set up the PA and the riggers and the lighting guys. They're not donating their time, and some artists are paid insane amounts of money to be a part of the benefit, and then promote themselves as benefactors. We had no interest in being part of that. That's not what I consider a true benefit. Yes, money has to go for basic infrastructure, for insurance and water, make sure people are fed. But at the end of the day, everybody should be donating their time, and the cash should go to the actual cause. So much of the energy they put into these things seems misdirected. How about saving the guy who's dying in the alley right next to your house?
Maynard, true to form, recognized the comedic side of the fundraising efforts. He'd heard the rumors about Frances Bean Cobain, daughter of Nirvana's Kurt Cobain and Hole frontwoman Courtney Love. He'd read in the tabloids of Courtney's suspected heroin use during her pregnancy and of the investigations that had led authorities to remove the baby from her parents when she was only 2 weeks old. He knew of the parade of nannies assigned to her care, of the toddler's visits to her father during his stay at the rehab center. "I read this stuff and thought, that poor girl is stuck with a tornado of a mother," Maynard would recall. "How will Frances Bean survive this crazy life?" Helping a 4-year-old caught up in a world of drug abuse and family dysfunction was a cause he could stand behind. A run of t-shirts would raise awareness of the child's plight. T-shirts he designed and produced and distributed to whomever laughed. White t-shirts printed across the front with the message, "Free Frances Bean." "I thought it was appropriately rude," he would explain. Courtney's behavior seemed to Maynard just one more symptom of the madness that was L.A. He'd been there for melees in the parking lot and snails-paced traffic on Wilshire, and for a tense and harrowing week in 1992, he'd watched the city erupt in riots and lootings in response to the acquittal of police officers responsible for the beating of Rodney King the year before. "L.A. was burning to the ground," he would remember. "I saw how quickly everything could go off the rails."
By 1996, I'd had enough. I'd been listening to Bill Hicks talking about L.A. falling into the ocean. In a way, I think I wanted it to, because so many people we met were negative and just kind of vampires. I felt like so much was polluting my ability to remember that it was all just a ride. You get so worked up into thinking it's not going to work out that you can't imagine that it will. And I had to get away.
For a long time, Maynard talked about leaving L.A., getting off the grid, Moon Zappa would recall. "I'd never met anybody so convinced something was going to happen, and that we had to get out of here fast." On the other side of the buckskins and the eagle tails were green valleys, wide expanses of rock and sky, quiet and space, and dusty streets terraced up a mountainside, golden in the sunset. And one morning in late summer, the new album completed and ready for production, Maynard loaded a rental van with his belongings. He placed a supply of strawberry Twizzlers on the seat beside him and drove across the city, past Sunset and Hollywood and Beverly Boulevard, and to the entrance ramp of I-10, eastbound. "I unpacked the van and put everything in the Jerome apartment," Maynard would recall, "and then I was on a bus again." The low-slung duplex stood at the eastern end of Jerome in a row of bungalows all alike, efficient units where mining crew foremen had lived years before. Maynard moved in cartons and bags and the black trunk, and with little time to set up housekeeping, took a deep breath and prepared for another international tour. He and Adam and Justin and Danny had found their groove. For the past year, they'd translated their shared vision to sound and story, to an ambitious album that would, as they knew it must, surpass their previous work. They'd hung the walls of the loft with whiteboards and covered them with equations and formulas, geometric depictions of intervals and reversed beats and fractional time signatures. As Tom would remark, "A rage song is easy," Jack Olson said in a 2014 interview. "A Tool song is not simple by any stretch of the imagination." Complex as it was, the music, as always, came first. Only after Danny and Adam and Justin had worked out melodies and motifs did Maynard put pen to paper. He drew upon all he'd studied, Jung's shadow self archetype, Melchizedek's genetic theories, Joseph Campbell's battle of opposites, and the redemption their union would bring, the angle of a jujitsu stance. He counterbalanced lyrics of healing with acid rock dissonance, juxtaposed images of destruction with poetic Eastern rhythms. And on September 17, 1996, the album was released, a sonic collage of metal and comedy, of Teutonic cadence and seagull cries, of wailing babies and the click of a skipping phonograph needle. The glittering cover art harkened back to the extravagant gatefold albums of decades before, and the dreamlike images on the picture disc and promotional posters were all Ramiro's. The spiritual nature of Ramiro's art represented Tool in a good way, Maynard would explain. It was a grounding factor. It was, then, an album of connection. An album dedicated to Bill Hicks. An album called Anima. It only took a bit of research for fans to discover the title's etymological roots. Anima, the Latin term for the soul and the feminine force, coupled with enema, a sophomoric allusion to the album's theme of spiritual cleansing. But as with most things Tool, the title's significance went beyond the obvious. I chose the name partly as a tribute to John Crowley, Maynard would explain. John Crowley, whose fictional doors and pathways had opened the way for Maynard, whose multi-volume Egypt series told the tale of lost histories and the hum of creative energies existing between souls. Every track was strong enough to hold its own, but Boston Globe music writer Steve Morse was among the first to articulate the album's larger artistic accomplishment. Anima's message, he pointed out in a November 15th review, could be best understood by a close listen, start to finish. This was no collection of random rock rants, no crazy quilt of sound effects and hidden meaning. Anima, he recognized, was an experience, a CD with a message, a sonic vehicle taking listeners on a journey. They obviously have a lot of darkness on the surface, Morse said of the band in a 2014 interview. But ultimately, there is an emphasis on communication and bringing people together. Maynard's lyrics didn't disguise his growing dislike of L.A., and even when California disappeared from the map when the lenticular jewel case was tipped just so, it didn't mean despair. All would be well, the songs urged, if one at last learned to swim, remembered one's place in the collective unconscious, one's role in the co-creation of the universe. Maynard has that spiritual side, Moon Zappa explained. He's doing something with that mind of his, and he's able to straddle being technically excellent at his job and taking you a little bit further. He's a philosopher with an audience and a microphone. Tool hadn't performed outside California since early 1995. But now the band would more than make up for lost time. In mid-October, they'd begin a nearly non-stop tour through the U.S., Europe, and Australia that would keep them on the road for much of the next 2 years. If the band's sound had reached a new maturity with the new album, Maynard's onstage moves had taken on new aspects as well. From their front row seats at L.A.'s American Legion Hall in October, Tom Morello and Brad Wilk could see the detailing of the Enochian magic board suspended behind Danny, and they were close enough, too, to notice Maynard's stomps and struts, the sharp jerk of his head when he passed near. He had a whole new repertoire of frontman behavior, Tom would recall. It was turkey behavior. The Anima tour made its way through the South and across the Midwest, on to Amsterdam and Paris and Auckland, and at every stop, audiences looked forward to what Maynard might wear nearly as much as they did the music. At first, his costume was no more outrageous than a mohawk or the red union suit he'd worn during the Undertow tour. In black sweatpants and Birkenstocks, he ducked and dodged across the stage, singing of boredom and burdens,
of balance and nipple rings, his bare torso glistening. But by the third show, he'd taken his look in a complete 180. His face was a kabuki mask of white, his eyes rimmed in thick black liner, his stare more penetrating than ever. In December, covered in blue and white body paint and clad only in print boxers, he crouched and swayed in a sinuous interpretive dance against the triple meter of Danny's floor tom. Just before the band departed for the Netherlands in January, Maynard temporarily abandoned dramatic attire altogether. When vocalist Tori Amos suggested he accompany her during her Madison Square Garden concert in support of RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, he didn't hesitate. The two had long admired each other's art, and when they'd met the summer before, they'd become fast friends, baking cookies from Judith's recipe and spending hours on the phone in the lonely Los Angeles nights. And when he'd opened the 1992 Napa Valley Silver Oak she'd given him, Maynard suddenly understood what Kurt had tried to tell him about pairing a fine Cabernet Sauvignon with a good steak.
Appearing with Tori was more important than my reservations about benefits in general. My being there helped the cause great, but it would also let people see what I was capable of. I was perceived as a metal dude, but that really isn't who I am. I needed to let out some of the more complex nuances that get lost in the sonic bulldozer that is Tool.
They sat close at the piano, their harmony creating of Tori's song, Muhammad My Friend, a passionate reminder of the feminine side of divinity. And that night, Maynard was the relaxed, smiling man in a gray crew neck, a singer more balladeer than bad boy. From Houston to Detroit to Ghent, Maynard's costuming became increasingly outré, and 10 months into the tour, he made his entrance at California's Concord Pavilion in flowing black curls, white face paint, and deep crimson lipstick, his floor-length silver gown slid up the front. He vamped across the stage, methodically stripping until he stood in the spotlight in only green panties and a scarlet bra, and sang of sacrifice and chaos, of the black holes of memory, of the dead Ohio sky. He and his bandmates had made it a point to focus attention on their art and had kept their likenesses from Tool videos and promotional materials. But with increasing fame came instant recognition. Too often, fans approached Maynard in cafes and airports and the corner store, expecting a few words of conversation as if they were old friends. In truth, all they really knew of him was what they'd interpreted from his gnomic lyrics, and that's the way he preferred it. The wigs and gowns and makeup might create a necessary diversion, he realized, a smokescreen to enable him to travel incognito in street clothes to the playground with his son.
Back when I watched early REM videos, I liked not having a clue what Michael Stipe looked like behind his hair. And you only heard of Swans, there were very few videos of them. Kiss would be on stage with all their makeup, and you'd wonder who they are, what they looked like. There was a power behind the characters. And when they took their makeup off, they were able to go on their merry way. In art school, Deb Rockman had taught us that less is more. You don't have to have every structural line in place to get the general gist of a painting or a charcoal drawing. And I didn't need to be recognized to tell the story. I felt like less was not only more, less was safer.
Silly costumes made it easier, he soon discovered, to at last bring humor into a Tool performance. During the summer's Lollapalooza tour, a new character emerged. Billy D., the mustachioed satyr from his country boner routine, had metamorphosed to the Reverend Maynard. Audiences had no trouble accepting the irreverent humor of the Southern preacher in a tan leisure suit. During breaks between Push It and Hooker with a Penis, the good Reverend called for hallelujahs from the mosh pit and invited volunteers to come forward and be healed of the curse of fundamentalism, all in the name of the Church of Jesus fucking Christ. By Ozfest 98, Maynard had adopted more effective camouflage than sequins and painted eyebrows and ball gowns. For a multitude of reasons, I receded to the back of the stage, he would explain.
As the eye contact became awkward, I stepped back. It was partly a technical decision. The sound was spilling into my mic from the cabinets behind me, but it also helped get away from the frontman label. I absolutely hate the phrase lead singer. I'm not a frontman. I'm just part of the story. The Lollapalooza faithful wandered in clouds of patchouli across the festival grounds. They examined woven bracelets and tie-dye skirts at the crafts booths, visited body-piercing tents, found cooling relief at the misting stations, and received, if they laughed, free Francis Bean t-shirts. When the opening bars of Anima rang out across the grounds, they turned their attention from the taco and samosa stands to the video projected on the rear of the stage. The disturbing, not-fit-for-MTV video of an alien straining at his shackles and driving a needle into his head. Boston Globe music writer Steve Morse considered Tool, with its Led Zeppelin echoes, illusory tempos, and enigmatic lyrics, the highlight of the main stage. "I thought they stole the show from Korn and Snoop Dogg," he said in a 2014 interview. "They were fresh and innovative and intriguingly mysterious." Maynard wasn't in the least confident that the audience had deciphered those mysteries. He watched as they flailed in the mosh pit, enraged as ever. And in more than a few shows that summer, he stepped forward and addressed the crowd. "There's a lot of misconceptions about this band," he said softly. "It's not about hate and violence, but about opening your heart." His lyrics spoke of picking at scabs and the coming Armageddon. But between the lines was a call to resist easy dogma, to see beyond the obvious, to choose compassion over fear, and help usher in a new age of cosmic consciousness. "Maynard has always had an undercurrent of something very positive," Morse said. "He doesn't say much on stage, but he comes up with these guru-like aphorisms that are quite striking." Maynard had paid attention when Paul Grout had cautioned against confusing metaphor with the truth it illuminated. He'd looked old hurts squarely in the eye, examined destructive patterns, recognized self-doubt as a delusion born of taking to heart the opinions of others. He'd translated his quest into songs, but some listeners could not separate the singer from the search.
"I was just interested in figuring out how math applies to human behavior, the geometry of emotions and all those things. Then people started looking to me like I had something to offer, like they thought I could solve their puzzle. They seemed to think I was the answer. Dude, I am definitely not the answer. I've got ideas. I can put band-aids on stuff, but I don't have the fucking answers." Writing those songs and performing them was like scream therapy. It felt good to have a good cry in my Haagen-Dazs. It helped me work through my own issues. I can do that, too. Go get some ice cream and cry in a corner. If you make me responsible for moving that piece in you, then I'm responsible for it all the time. But you can do it yourself. That's the whole message.
For every fan who mistook the pointing finger for the path, countless others understood that Maynard was no run-of-the-mill lyricist. He'd provided a map, but it was for them to determine the destination. They recognized in Tool more than an excuse to slam in the mosh pit. Anima was a mirror held up to fear and unresolved sorrow, an invitation to listen and listen again, to trust their own pure inner voice and step beyond the shadow self to a place of possibility. An album Cleveland music journalist Chris Aiken called a hard rock record for the thinking man.